This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. I'd like to thank our sponsors who make our podcast possible. We tape our podcast with the ongoing support of Raider and Jason Sikora, our sound engineer. Raider is a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. Iberia Bank and First Horizon, who are now one bank. Two relationship-driven banks, both leaders in the industry, have officially joined forces. The combination of Iberia Bank and First Horizon creates a leading financial services company dedicated to enriching the lives of their clients, associates, and their communities. I'd also like to thank Lafayette General Health, who has joined the Ochsner Health family and is now Ochsner Lafayette General. As one health system, Ochsner Lafayette General will provide expanded services and enhanced care from the familiar faces you already trust. Ochsner Lafayette General means more resources to help solve healthcare's toughest problems, reinvesting in our communities, and being further committed to health and wellness. Ochsner Lafayette General. Together means more. Learn more today at togethermeansmore.org. Our guest today is David Cherami, Chief Executive Officer of the Bayou Vermilion District. Serving in that position since 2011, David previously served as Executive Director of CODEFIL, the Council for the Development of French in Louisiana. His entire adult career has focused on Francophone issues, from teaching in schools to spreading information about the unique culture of our region. David earned a PhD in Francophone Studies from USL, now known as UL at Lafayette. A prolific writer, he has published dozens of articles, presented at innumerable conferences, and taught French in middle, high school, and at the university level. The Bayou Vermilion District, or BVD, was founded in 1984 by an act of the legislature to beautify, manage, and preserve the Vermilion River. The BVD also oversees operations of the Vermilionville Living History and Folklife Park, a 23-acre preserve situated along the banks of the Bayou Vermilion. Visitors can learn about our region by seeing depictions of the Acadian, Creole, Native American, and African cultures from the time period of 1765 through 1890. You can also experience guided tours, live music, a cooking school, dance lessons, and boat tours. And you can also shop at La Boutique, which offers a unique selection of arts and crafts, literature, and music CDs from the area. There's a lot to talk about. So David Cherami, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for being available for the podcast. We're still muddling through with COVID. But
yes, just one correction, though. We don't have live music, unfortunately, right now.
Well, you do normally, right?
We do normally, yes. And once this is all over with, there will be a two-stepping our way across the dance floor, hopefully, very soon.
Yeah, I saw you've been postponing things. But I wanted to get in what a unique treasure we have right here that many people that I'm assuming live and work here may not have ever even visited Vermilionville.
I'm astonished by the number of people who tell me that, you know, either that, you know, I didn't know you were there, because we're kind of hidden. We're out of the way. We're behind the, near the airport, rather, right on the banks of the Vermilion. You don't run across us by accident. You have to find us. Either they didn't know we were there, or when they do come, for example, they get married in their late 20s, early 30s, whatever, and said, oh, I haven't been here since I, you know, went on a class trip in eighth grade. I said, well, where the heck you been all these years? You come back, we're here, please, you know, enjoy the facilities here as much as possible, because it's a public facility. You know, it was built for and with public funds, and it's there for the public at Lafayette, and also as a tourist attraction. To help diversify the economy of the area.
Right. Well, you're French to the bone. You told me your family is originally from France.
But you didn't. About 14 generations back.
Still. But you didn't grow up speaking French.
No.
If you want to get into your career, like what led you to this point, David?
Well, I'm part of that lost generation, I guess we like to call ourselves, where our parents were raised bilingually. My grandparents spoke French as a first language. My parents spoke French as a first language also, but they learned to speak English. My four grandparents, only one actually was could read or write, and he could do so both in French and in English, quite frankly. But my parents did not raise me or my sisters in French because that just wasn't done, you know, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s anymore.
They had been discouraged.
They had been been beaten in school, punished, humiliated, taught that it wasn't good French, that they were ignorant, whatnot. So that's so they didn't want to pass that stigma on to their children. But like I said, I grew up in a French-speaking household. My grandmother lived with us, and she never spoke a word of English in her life, and I could never speak to her, even though I tried and many times. But, you know, I was always pulled by other things going on in my life at that time, I guess you could say, being in high school and going off to college. But that was always something in the back of my head. I always wanted to learn to speak French. I always thought it was something essential. Mm-hmm. I always heard French spoken. I knew what French was supposed to sound like.
It's beautiful.
Yes, it is. And I also have, you know, I guess even though I wasn't raised in French, I was raised in with a French culture, I guess you could say, Cajun culture. So it was all very familiar to me also. And I just wanted to really learn to speak French, especially when I got to college. I studied history at Loyola in New Orleans. And there, of course, there was a large population of Hispanic students with me. And I'm still good friends with some of my Cuban friends, or Cuban-American friends, I guess you could say, from down in Miami. And I just thought it was just great that they were able to switch back and forth between Spanish and English and American culture and Cuban culture. And I said, I should be able to do that. You know, why can't I do that? Why can't more of my generation do that? You know, I mean, we were taught to speak English so we could be, you know, des bons Américains, you know, some good Americans. But here we had these Hispanic kids who were United States, and they were just as American as I was.
Of course, but
they had, in this whole Spanish background.
Their own culture.
Mm-hmm. And I knew that I needed to have access to the language in order to fully have access to the culture. And so that's after I graduated from college, I decided to take a year off through Cotterville, and I went to study in Montpellier, France, on the beautiful Mediterranean coast. It's still a town that I consider my home in France whenever I go to France.
How did Cotterville assist?
Well, they had these programs back in the day. Of course, they've stopped doing that for different reasons. But they would send college students, like a junior year abroad kind of program.
Oh, but what an opportunity for you.
But I had already graduated, so my only goal was to learn to speak French. Uh-huh. And the added lagniappe, as we say, was that I was able to find the prettiest French girl who would have me and bring her back to the United States.
That's
and marry
wonderful,
her.
David.
Yeah, so we've been together all these years, almost 40 years now.
Did you have to commit to work in something that would be promoting the French culture when Cotterville assisted you? Was there some kind of a, like, you know, the military, you say, I'll serve. Did you have to agree to serve?
No, it's not like that. Now they do something like that. There is something called Escadrille Lafayette, which is an homage to an Air Force squadron that was named after the Marquis de Lafayette, who went back to help French liberate themselves from their occupation, the same way the Marquis de Lafayette helped the Americans liberate ourselves from, I guess you could say, the British rule also.
Right.
And they get a teaching job, teach English in France, and when they come back, they have to teach French for a few years.
So, that's a fair trade.
But in my time, we didn't have that type of deal, but... But yeah, that was sort of the beginning of my journey into French, and a lot of people have had the same experience like me, who might have grown up in a French household or with a French background in South Louisiana. And once they were able to become fluent, they all described the same thing, same experience. It was like the dam was broken, like the floodgates were open. All of a sudden, you understood so much. You know, this whole part of your personality got opened up because people tell you that also when you learn to speak a second language, you take on a slightly different personality. Mm-hmm. So that it was, they're all saying, this is like my real personality finally coming out because I have access to it through the language.
Yeah.
So that was a very emotional experience and I remember the exact moment that happened too, where I could tell myself, oh my God. I'm thinking, I'm dreaming, I'm actually speaking. These people are talking to me in French, and I'm actually understanding what they're telling me.
Wow.
You know, it was a very strong moment, yeah.
So you wanted more, so you moved here to Lafayette to attend USL.
Oh, I had a... That was,
to get a PhD,
it was a
right?
Long, it was a long trip coming back to Lafayette. After I came back from France, I went to law school for a year at LSU Law School.
Oh, I saw that on your resume. Yeah,
for one year.
I went there. You didn't like it?
One year was enough? It was, yeah, they kind of just figured, I guess, that we weren't meant for each other, mm-hmm. I guess, me and the law. And I really wanted to go back to France. And so we went back to France for about 7 years, actually. I lived in France for quite a long time, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Before coming back. And then... Actually, it was kind of interesting the way I got back to Lafayette is in
January. And you say back to Lafayette. You didn't grow up here.
No. I mean back to South Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say back to Louisiana. No, I grew up in Golden Meadow, mm-hmm. in Lafourche Parish. In January of 1989, that was the bicentennial of the French Revolution, and some USL professors, David Barry, Mate mm-hmm. Alain, Vaughn Simpson, her late husband, also were part of there, and we had a big banquet. They were there for a seminar, I guess you could say. And I got invited because I was from Louisiana, and I just started talking to him, and David Barry said, yeah, we're starting this new PhD program. You'd be great. You and your wife, we'd help you all.
He was over liberal arts.
Right. He was the dean of liberal arts, but he was the department head of foreign languages.
Well, Cindy's one of my best friends.
Oh, Cindy, I love her. She and my wife worked together for many years at Lafayette High. Also, my wife taught for many years at Lafayette High. And so my wife and I, I wasn't going anywhere in the job I had. Yeah. I was working as a clothing salesman, basically. In a large department store, I guess mm-hmm. you could say, kind of. It was actually modeled. The owner actually modeled his business model on Walmart. He'd gone to Bentonville a couple of times and kind of modeled his business model on Walmart. So that was like kind of a Walmartish.
What town were you in France?
Well, I got moved around a lot, but it was mostly in southern France, uh-huh. in Provence, a town called Apt, a town called Cavaillon, a town called Groyer. Groyer is a small little town in southern France.
Uh-huh. But you got to experience, the country. You
really I mean, that was the best experience. I really learned French society inside and out by working mm-hmm. in a store, because you mm-hmm. understand how the people live their culture, what the food, the actual foods they eat, the clothes mm-hmm. they wear, what makes them tick, mm-hmm. I really became indistinguishable from a French person at that time. When I told people I was American, they did not believe me. It's until I started speaking in English. Your English is too good to not be French.
Start pulling out some slang.
Yeah. I came back in 89 and been here ever since.
So you got your PhD at USL in Francophone.
Right.
Studies.
I was the second. That was a new program. Like I said, David Barry was talking mm-hmm. about just getting it started. And it took a few years before it really got moving. Mm-hmm. And I was actually the second person to get the PhD in Francophone Studies from USL.
That's great. Yeah. So you're a prolific writer. I want to be talking about Bougainville, of course, but I think your background sets the mm-hmm. stage for your love mm-hmm. of our culture.
Yeah,
to protect that culture and to preserve mm-hmm. it for people to learn more about where we live. But you want to talk a little bit about that? You ended up at, I know you did other things, but you ended up at Codafil.
Yeah, well, I was hired right before I finished my PhD, before mm-hmm. I finished my dissertation, which was good because, I've been living as a student for almost 10 years, and my wife was really helping us keep things going, quite mm-hmm. frankly.
Time to
get a real day job, right. And but I had been inspired by people like Barry Ancelet, who's still my great role models to this day, in the fact that we have made so many more ways to promote the culture, and reading and writing it, because like I said, we've always been taught that we're just a bunch of stupid Cajuns. You can't even read or write. The French we speak isn't correct French and whatnot. And so with Barry and others, we say, well, yes, it is good French. As a matter of fact, we can write it. It can be written, and it is written and published. So I started writing, and actually got three books of poetry published, two in Canada, one here in Louisiana, through Centenary College. A lot of people don't realize that Centenary College in Shreveport is a hotbed of French activity, quite frankly. Yes, they have a French publishing house. That's Dr. Dana Kress, who is the department head up there, who's been just a driving force for French throughout the state, but in North Louisiana too. He founded a publishing house where they publish authors like myself and mm-hmm. people like Kirby Jambon, who is the current poet laureate of French Louisiana, who's also published three books of poetry at Les Editions Tintamarre. as it's called, in Shreveport. So yeah, it was just getting a lot of activity to promote the language, not only through the music and the food, mm-hmm. which is important, but also that it is a written language. It is in addition to being a spoken language.
What type of poetry did you write?
Well, I write kind of free verse, kind of reflections on the culture. I often make a conscious effort to use our particular French vernacular, because a lot of times, you know, I'll be speaking to French people and I'll use a word for here. For example, in South Louisiana, a word for a raccoon is a shawi. A shawi is a Native American word, because when the Europeans came over to North America, they had never seen a raccoon before because it's native to North America. So in South Louisiana, we use like words like bayou also, mm-hmm. or Native American words, because a bayou is a type of body of water that really doesn't exist elsewhere, you know, being part of an estuary system and whatnot. So when we started saying shawi, we'd get corrected, you know, and he's saying, oh no, c'est un raton laveur. And raton laveur literally means a big washing rat. And when you think about it, you know, a raccoon, yeah, it kind of looks like a rat, and it does wash its food, mm-hmm. but that's what the Europeans call it. But I say, no, the Indians knew it well before them, and that's the word we use. So I'll throw in words like that, just say, get it in print, I guess you could say, make it.
Right.
Because there's an expression in French that said, you know, the spoken word flies away, but the written word stays.
Yes.
And so we're trying to get these words to stay, you know, so mm-hmm. people can learn about them for generations to come.
Yeah. Well, when I looked at your bio, I was telling you this before we started taping, everything was in French, and mm-hmm. I thought, oh my goodness, I couldn't. I saw that you'd written poetry, and I mm-hmm. know you've published. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were dozens of things you've published, yeah. but it's all French.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Everything has been.
I write mostly in French. Yeah, uh-huh. I've been writing also a column in French for Acadiana Profile for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. En Français, s'il vous plaît, which is kind of I wouldn't say ironic, but I remember when Acadiana Profile, when it was still run by the Andrews family. Mm-hmm. It was almost a bilingual, almost more French than English. And I remember picking up copies of Acadiana Profile and seeing all that French in there. I said, man, I'd love to write for this magazine one day. You
know? That's a great periodical.
It is. And it was taken up by Renaissance Publishing mm-hmm. About 10 years ago with Errol Laborde, who's the big honcho over there. And it's Errol, actually, who called me one day and asked me, do you want to write for Acadiana Profile in French? And I said,
isn't that something? Sure.
Yeah, I mean, sure, of course I do. Yeah. And I've been doing that ever since. Mm-hmm. And recently I've been doing an English column also, which has a French title. It's called Plus ça change, which comes from the French expression a lot of people know is the more it changes, the more things stay the same. Mm-hmm. We're talking right about in English about how some people, you know, continue the traditions of the past, but trying to make it renew it. You know, mm-hmm. I've written about like Louis and Ashley Michaud, great artists and musicians who are very steeped in tradition, but are doing some new and exciting things. Mm-hmm. Jordan Thibodeau and Cedric Watson, you know, two young Cajun and Creole musicians who are very steeped once again in the tradition, but doing some very new and exciting things with the culture. So that's kind of the focus of that, you know, how things are changing, but they're still the same, you know?
Right, right. David, let's hold that thought for a moment. I'd like to take a break and look back at one of our past podcasts, which reminds me of the conversation we're having about French. This Discover Lafayette interview featured Louis and André Michaud of the Lost Bayou Ramblers that aired in May of 2019. It can be found at discoverlafayette.net. Louis is the lead singer of the award-winning Lost Bayou Ramblers and sings all of their songs in French. It's an important reminder of the efforts being undertaken to preserve the beautiful Acadian and Creole culture of our region. I read with interest that you guys grew up with a French family, but you didn't know French necessarily.
Yeah, like so many people around here.
Exactly, because it wasn't spoken, because people weren't allowed to speak it in school, and it just wasn't spoken.
Right,
so it
right,
was almost
right.
lost for so many families.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
Yeah.
That's our grandfather, who grew up between Lafayette and Mamou, lived in Mamou for a good while, and then born in Lafayette, then Mamou, then back to Lafayette. He didn't speak French, and then and our dad and most of his brothers learned it mm-hmm. growing up, and the same with Louis, like he was saying earlier, went to Canada, learned it up
immersed,
there.
Yeah, in the program.
Yeah. And now his kids and his wife are very fluent in it.
My grandmother was French-Canadian, and so I would hear it growing up. Both sides of my family spoke French, but yet, you know, they knew they could talk in front of us, and the children didn't know what they were talking about. They probably, you know, cussing us out. But I just found that interesting that now you only sing in French.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the rhythm of the music.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Doesn't make sense without it. And it's a beautiful thing, and it's really a very special language or group of languages, if you will. It's just such a, there's so many different dialects here in Louisiana. It's like just fascinating to kind of learn from different people, and everyone speaks a little differently, but everyone can understand each other, and it's beautiful. I mean, if you ask me what kind of French I spoke, I guess I would say Cajun or Creole, only in this fact that it's its own thing. It changes from house to house, from town to town. Mm-hmm. And I learned from people who speak Creole, and I learned from people who speak Cajun, I learned from people who speak French. And so just put it all together, and that's Louisiana French. You know, it's a universal French.
Yeah.
Thank you for being with us. We're here with David Cheremy, CEO of the Bayou Vermilion District, and we're talking about his really illustrious career, and we're about to start and talk about what led you to the Bayou Vermilion District. How did you end up as CEO?
Well, like I said before that, I was working at Cotafil, and Cotafil was going through a lot of changes. I was going through some changes also, and the job came open, you know, the CEO position at Bayou Vermilion came open. I said, well, you know, I think it's time to change courses, you know, in my life. And even it's not that big a jump, really, quite frankly, at least on the cultural side, learning about the environment, the ecosystem of there. That was a bit of a jump, but not that much, because I've always tried to put the emphasis since, even before I came to this position, help people understand the relationship between the culture and the land and the water, how we are part of the land and the land is part of us, and it's just inseparable. You know, we wouldn't have the same culture if it wouldn't work for the fishermen and the hunters and the trappers and the farmers and the people who raise horses and cattle. I mean, that's all, you know, anchored into our culture so deeply, and that's really what informs our culture to a great extent. So we wouldn't have the same culture if we had a different environment, and the environment is shaped also by the people who live there. So that's the emphasis I try to put as far as that is making that connection between the land and the culture.
So when the students come on field trips, are those the type of things that you're you know, your staff is teaching?
Yeah, well, we have different I guess packets, I guess you could call them. You know, if they want to have more of an environmental bent to it, I guess you could say we do experiments where they can do searching for macroinvertebrates in the water, testing for dissolved oxygen levels, testing for suspended solids in the water. You know, doing a scientific analysis of the water. Or they can come and learn about, you know, different crafts like blacksmithing. We have a forge there, and you can learn about blacksmithing and how important that the blacksmith was probably the most important artisan in the town, because you couldn't run out to the hardware store and pick up a hammer. If you needed a hammer, you had to build it yourself. You know, if you needed any tool you needed, you had to build it yourself. You couldn't run out and purchase one at Freight Tools or Harbor Freight or whatever it is, it didn't exist. And we try to teach a little bit about how working the land also. For example, we also have a large exhibit about textiles, and so we go all the way talking about raising cotton, especially brown cotton, which is an indigenous form of cotton, which was not readily commercialized because the fibers are shorter, so it's not as valuable on the market, but it was used for homegrown purposes, and so people had to grow their cotton and then take the seeds out of the cotton, then comb the cotton and make with something called roulags, which is when you card the cotton, you make the little rolls of cotton and put it on the loom and make the thread and take the, I mean, on the spinning wheel, and then take the thread and put that on the loom and then weave. Before, you know, it could go from a year from the time you plant the seed until you wear your new skirt. It could be over a year, you know.
Yeah. So you really had to take care of what you had.
You had to teach people how to nurture, and you had to take care of the land to make sure that it was able to produce the next year and not overproduce. And we talk a lot about organic farming also, which is a very hot topic nowadays. And my tagline is, we call this organic farming, or as they called it in the 19th century, farming.
Yeah. Yeah. Forming with sense.
Forming with sense.
We're going to be consuming this. So we want to make sure
and nothing goes to waste, you know, using all the materials that the nature gives us and put back to nature as much as we can. So we can, so the next year when the crops come up again, make sure they're there for everybody. So
my daughter, Kelly, when she was, I think it was maybe third and fourth grade, fifth grade, that age, she did a program through UL at Lafayette. And they would have kids selected from the schools, and they got to take some summer programs. And I remember she had some cooking classes and I think some scientific experiments, too. I mean, she loved it. It's just like a mecca for all ages, but especially for children because they get it. You know?
Yeah, they're open and receptive to these new ideas, and they understand, you know the connections they have between the cooking and the ingredients you put into the cooking, and it's also it's chemistry. Also, cooking is chemistry. Also, basically, putting in the right ingredients to, for the right amount of time, the right temperature. You know, it's a scientific experiment in and of itself.
And it was delicious. I remember that because they invited the parents to come in. So David, for Bayou Vermilionville, let's start first with BVD. How are you funded? I'm getting my two groups mixed up. How is BVD funded, if you can explain that?
Our main source of funding is a millage that we get. We're the smallest millage. We just, because of the lowering of the overall value of land and I guess you could say, in property in Lafayette Parish, we were allowed by the state constitution to bump up our millage, because otherwise we'd have been getting less money, but the state constitution allows us to move up our millage so that you can get the same amount of money that you had the previous year.
In 2020, going into 2019 to 2020. Because I saw in the past you collected about 2.1 million.
In the past, but now we're around about 1.6. We're evaluated to get so much, but we don't get all that money because not all taxes that are assessed are collected. But we get about 95%, which is average. So we get about 1.7 million from the millage, and also we have other sources of income. We have
The other amount is we have from operations.
We have grants and something called revenue sharing through the state, et cetera. And then Vermilionville itself raises money. I mean, we have admissions and the restaurant and receptions and the dance hall and all that. But of course, that revenue is way down,
right?
Because we just don't have any tour groups. Foreigners, I guess you could say the French
visitors.
And the French speaking canoeers can't come right now.
But we can still go, right? It's still open.
We're open. As a matter of fact, and thank goodness we are. I mean, we still have a lot of support from the public. We're still having a few, gatherings, I guess you could say, of smaller group of people. We could still have some gatherings, but not the huge things that we've used to in the past. And we've hosted, things like the Black Pot Festival, where we've had, thousands of people show up over the Halloween weekend. Our cultural days also, we've had over 1,000 people come for our, we have Acadian Culture Day, Creole Culture Day, and Native American Culture Day. And all this past year that I went virtual, it was all online because we want people to come, but we don't want 1,200 people to show up.
That's
it'd be almost, even though we're on 23 acres, it would be kind of hard for us to socially distance at that time.
It's such a great facility. I've been out there to eat and held a couple of events for Upper Lafayette, and it's just a beautiful setting. So I know you're ready to see that opened up again.
Yep. Well, we had just had the LCVC luncheon, the monthly luncheon was there, and we did it socially distanced. We had about 30 or so people show up, and we did virtually also, but we had all the tables at least 6 feet apart, we had a buffet, but we was being served by one of our employees. So, I mean, we're taking all our precautions. Everybody's wearing a mask. Everybody, washing their hands, doing everything we can possibly to make sure everything is safe. And we wipe everything down, at least twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, all the touchable surfaces. And, so we're following all the CDC guidelines to make sure everybody's as safe as can be to come here to Vermilionville.
Yeah. You know, this may be putting you on the spot, but I've been reading that consumers and others, as we move forward from COVID, a lot of these different changes in procedure may stay part of
you know, our culture. I'm wondering as we move forward, hopefully one day the mask can come off, but some of these cleaning, not that we have to clean every hour, but I can see a lot of this being incorporated, you know, more sanitizing. It's going to be hard to forget this.
I think Zooming and those type you know, having, you know, it's, people complain about it, you know, there's a lot of jokes and memes going on around about that, but I think it has the advantage that it could bring people from great distances.
Right.
I've done a few conferences actually recently to talk about my poetry with some universities, actually with Princeton, Hanover College in Pennsylvania, UL, and one of this past semester. And in one of the classes, we had, so the students are all scattered because the schools are all, you know, online also. But some of the students in that class were from, one was in Zimbabwe, another one was in France, another one was in California, another one was in Pennsylvania.
The internet.
We're over 15, I don't know how many different time zones, you know. But it was just amazing that we were able to gather all these people from all over the planet, quite frankly. So, you know, just to come listen to little old me talk about Louisiana French, you know.
It's a silver lining, I think, as sad as this has been, it's a silver lining for us to be able to share in the way you're talking about. So have I asked you what you wanted me to ask about Vermilionville? Because I want to get in how wonderful this facility is. Is there anything I should have asked you?
Well, that we are accredited now. We are the only accredited museum in Lafayette by the American Alliance of Museums. Annie Fontenot, Annie Mahoney Fontenot, and Megan Smith were the driving force behind that. That was like a 2 or 3 year process, putting all kind of different policies and procedures in place.
You're the only accredited only one in Lafayette.
Wow. And a couple of others are in that process right now.
Yeah, I know that's not an easy
accreditation. It is not easy. I put these policies in place to make sure everything is being followed. You know, in Vermilionville has had a lot of turnover in the past. And so our collections management was not what it should have been, quite frankly. And luckily, we were able to put people in place right now. And now we have a collections management policy in place, and we're having keeping track of our artifacts a lot better with the provenance and all of that, who made the donations. So now we have a better, much better idea of what we have. And but we still got a long ways to go, because it's not to blame anybody, but it was a mess for a while. And luckily, we have people on staff right now who can straighten all that out.
Good. So I want to encourage people to look at Vermilionville as a destination for their families. Tell people that, you know, people will call me, where should I go when I'm in Lafayette? I mean, this should be one of the top destinations. And eat while you're there and enjoy.
Oh, we are very proud of our gumbo. We you know, have one of, if not the best gumbo in Lafayette. Our bread pudding, very proud of our bread pudding too. And we have our plate lunches every day. We're open Tuesday through Sunday. And we have a buffet on Sundays, but once again, it's served by one of our employees. So it's very popular. So come on out. Unfortunately, we don't have live music on Sundays. That was always a big attraction. But hopefully, very soon, we'll be able to have live bands. As a couple of Cajun and Creole musicians have told me in the past, you know, that you're one of the few places now that we can play on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, even though it's, you know, the festival circuit is really the main way a lot of musicians make their living now, but locally we're one of the few places where, you know, Cajun and Creole bands can play on a regular basis.
Yeah, we've got to watch out for our artists, definitely. Well, if we may shift, David, I'd like you to talk about what the Bayou Vermilion District, you know, the environmental focus of your group. I know it's to beautify and preserve the Vermilion River, and there's so many things that we all do, you know, like I'm not going to go dump a washing machine in the bayou.
You're not, but somebody will.
Somebody will. Yeah. And that's the things that we all like, what? How can that happen? But then when you drive down the street and you see people are paid crew mowing a yard and then blowing all the grass cuttings in the road right by the drains, we all probably do something that affects the ecology of our river. If you want to talk about that, I think we're ignorant about how little things really add up.
Well, people don't realize that how the watershed works. I mean, everything drains to the bayou in Lafayette Parish, except a small corner in the southwest that goes into the Mermental. But the vast majority of all the water in Lafayette Parish goes into the into the Vermilion, as well as all the trash that might be flowing after a strong rain event, for example. Our guys who are out there on the bayou just about every day know they have to get ready because there's going to be a big flushing effect, and they'll be having to pick up a lot of trash for the next couple of days after that.
So they ride around on boats and
well, we physically collect. Pull the trash one by one. Excuse me, out of the bayou. We have a system of booms. These are like these big oil booms you might have seen that using in oil cleanups after an oil spill. We put those in the mouths of several coolies throughout the parish.
To
keep it from going into the bayou itself. Uh-huh. That way our guys can go in there and pick them up. We also have a large trash trap called a bandalong, which is on Coulee Mean right off of South College.
Oh, yeah.
Which pulls out, you know, tons and tons of trash. We have a 20-yard container out there where we pull the trash trap out, we dump it out, and that 20-yard, we empty that out about once a month, 12, 13 times a year.
What type of stuff do you see?
Oh, you name it. I mean, it's mostly trash, styrofoam.
Like fast food?
Wrappers, cups, plastic bottles, glass bottles. A lot of balls, basketballs, soccer balls, footballs.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
They just roll away.
Just roll away, I guess. Uh-huh. We could open up a sporting goods store, I guess, with all that we pull out.
Consignment shop.
But that's the kind of things we find in the coulee itself. Otherwise, driving along the banks of the bayou, like you say, we'll find, you know, every now and then sofas and washing machines.
That just blows my mind. Who would do that?
Tires. Uh-huh. Also, we just discard tires. Yeah. We've every year about over 200 tires we pick up. We actually have to have a tire, waste tire permit with the state to be able to handle uh-huh. those, whatnot. But like I said, the majority of the trash has to be picked out with the little pickers one by one mm-hmm. to fill up these 55-barrel drums. And we fill about 1,000 or more of those barrels every year.
How many employees do you have on that crew?
On that crew, we have five employees. We have one crew mm-hmm. foreman and four guys mm-hmm. go out there just about every day to pick that up. And also, they take trees out of the bayou also. As a matter of fact, we got a call from a gentleman who said there's a tree fell in the bayou by his house. So we go by and pick that up because that also affects navigation, and that also affects drainage, quite frankly, because these trees and other trash can get caught up in the bridges. And the water won't flow mm-hmm. the way it needs to be flowed and can back up. So we do contribute also to helping alleviate some of the flooding problems we have. But our flooding problems are something well beyond anything that BVD can handle. But we try to contribute, you know, as much as we can.
Are you in all those discussions when people are talking about should they dredge the river? Is that the table?
Oh yeah, we're part of that. Mm-hmm. There's the Cadan Planning Commission led mm-hmm. by Monique Boulay is in charge right now of trying to coordinate among all the different parishes.
Yeah.
And municipalities within the watershed, because as we learned in 2016, the water doesn't know where the parish lines are, and it doesn't really care. You know, mm-hmm. so we have to be able to work across parish lines, across parish public works and whatnot, so we can coordinate. Because we realize that something we do on one end of the parish or in one parish can negatively affect on another parish.
That's what I was thinking. You know, it always seemed like a good idea. Well, yeah, let's just dredge mm-hmm. the Vermilion.
Yeah.
But then the unforeseen results.
Well,
there's
a lot of resistance to that. I think some spot dredging could probably do a lot of good also. Mm-hmm. But a complete dredging, that could lead to saltwater intrusion. And the people in Vermilion Parish do not want that because mm-hmm. that's not good for the rice farmers and the crawfish farmers down there.
And the hunters, huh?
And the duck hunters, too, I guess. They won't come.
I know that from my family here. Salt water is bad news. Mm-hmm, but, you know, it's funny. We're here. Like, I live right by the Vermilion. Mm-hmm. And none of my neighbors, I'm knocking on wood. I don't want to jinx this. But the 2016 flood, all these major floods, no one here mm-hmm. off of Mall Street has flooded. Mm-hmm. But just right mm-hmm. one, two streets over, mm-hmm. major flooding mm-hmm. on Tesh. And mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think of some of those back streets that flooded. And we're so close. Mm-hmm. Like you can just walk across mm-hmm. some property and be right there. Yeah. And it's just amazing how the Vermilion must be configured to cause that type of flooding.
It's a very complex system also. Yeah. And it'll flow backwards on occasion, also mm-hmm. going into the Cypress Island Swamp behind the airport, which is what it's supposed to do because that's like a natural detention pond or retention, I guess. There's a difference between a detention and a retention pond, but I'm not going to go into that, but it's a retention pond that needs some work done on it. I think, there's all kind of work that needs to be done. There are some like spoil banks for some of the pipelines going across the Atchafalaya that need to be looked at because it's not, it's preventing the water from flowing as efficiently as it needs to be. There's a lot of issues that need to be looked at also. But one thing we have to remember is that going back to the 2016 flood, we had over 30 inches of rain in a 36-hour period. Mm-hmm. Our annual rainfall is anywhere between 50 and 70 inches a year. So we had we had 6 months worth of rain in 36 hours.
Wow.
And somebody, I think it might have been Rob Perillo, who said that the amount of water that came down is equivalent to all the water in Lake Pontchartrain. Mm-hmm. So imagine Lake water Pontchartrain getting dumped on us in a day and a half.
So no municipality could have fought that off.
We do have, you know, we are coming into a different rain pattern right now, like we saw in 2016, but we saw not too long after that with Hurricane Harvey. And quite frankly, we've seen some of the hurricanes this past hurricane season where they just kind of go from a depression to a Cat 4 within hours, you know. So these major flare-ups. Luckily, a lot of this has been happening offshore. But with Harvey and with the 2016 flood, we had these hurricanes that were forming right offshore, and before anybody could do anything about it, we were mm-hmm. hurricane force rainfalls.
Right. You've had to learn a lot in 10 years. It sounds like.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I've always been very close to nature. You know, like I said, I grew up on Bayou Lafourche. You know, my parents' house where I grew up was like 50 yards from the bayou, you know, and it was kind of like a rite of passage, you know, being able to go water skiing in the bayou and swimming in the bayou and crabbing in the bayou, you know. So, I'm a bayou boy from day one.
I did ask you that earlier if you knew Coach O from LSU. Y'all grew
Bibi.
Up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I still call him Bibi. We all call him Bibi. I want to do him as BB. Yeah.
What a character.
Oh, he was always something else. He's a force of nature. He was always like that. Like I was telling you before, I remember he was a sophomore when I was a senior, and he was already starting as a sophomore.
Were you at the same school?
Yeah, South Lafourche. Mm-hmm. South Lafourche Tarpons and Bobby Hebert was between us. He was a year between us. Oh, uh-huh. He was a junior, and when BB was a sophomore and I was a senior. Baby. So I know Bobby J also, because, you know, down the bar we all have our nicknames. Because
what was yours?
Zero.
Zero. No, wait. Zero.
Because
did you earn that nickname?
I wasn't that good at football, but I did do. I was in drama. I did. I was in some plays, and we always stay late after school, and we always had this vending machine that had zero candy bars.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I just had zero bars, and I still love zero bars. So they just started calling me Zero because of the zero candy bars.
Well, at least it's not something else. I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't because and I wasn't making zeros in all my exams, but. Yeah, but Bobby J, we called him Bobby J because his father was Mr. Bobby, who unfortunately was one of the first to pass away from COVID in the state. And we always say he was the real Bobby Hebert, Mr. Bobby was, and Bobby J and Bebe, because that's just his nickname. Everybody had nicknames. We had guys like Crowbar on the team. Who else did we have? Pet Milk with somebody else from down the bar. That was his nickname. Also, we have all kind of great nicknames. So.
Yeah.
Caimon, which is alligator in Louisiana French, you know, so everybody had these great nicknames.
Yeah. You're lucky that you got to stay in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. You're getting to experience the best, and you're still relatively close to home. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, as we wind down, David, you know, I want to just close with some of the Vermilion River issues. What are a few things you can tell us that we can do to be good stewards of our water and our land?
Well, like the tagline goes, give a hoot, don't pollute. I mean, a lot of our problems would be solved if people just didn't throw their trash out in the out the window of their car, you know, their fast food or whatever, or just dumping things on the side of the road or whatever. I think that could go a long way.
It flies out the back of trucks.
That's
a
big thing.
If you see it, stop and go get it.
We're lucky to have a man like Mr. Matt Stuller, who started Parish Proud. You know, is trying to raise awareness. It's all about education. That's what Mr. Stuller was saying. It's a question of education. Once people realize what they're doing, you know, maybe they'll think twice about doing it the next time. You know, people don't realize that the water flows into the bayou. You know, say you throw something, it just goes away. But like we say also, there's no away. The bayou is away. That's where it goes. It goes mm-hmm. to the bayou.
And, it's, and that affects all of us.
And that affects all of us. It affects yeah. the wildlife also, which we love so dearly here in South Louisiana. But also, we've also embarking on a very large project. We're building a new building, our watershed testing lab and exhibit. Also, as part of the exhibit part, as part of the education part, we're going to be teaching people about how water works in the watershed, all the different issues, how water is essential to life, how we're the only planet in the solar system that has liquid water, and that's mm-hmm. essential to life. We wouldn't mm-hmm. have that if we weren't for water. And also we're going to have a testing lab where we're going to be testing for impediments to the water quality. Also, we have a program of septic tank inspections yeah, also.
That's very important.
Yes, fecal coliform is probably our major impediment right now. People don't realize that that their septic tank might be leaking or might mm-hmm. not be working correctly. And as a matter of fact, even our guys who go out there to inspections, sometimes they come across people who don't even realize they have a septic tank.
Oh, no. Really? Yes,
yeah, they,
we had one of those when I lived out in the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to maintain that.
You have to maintain that. And
it seems like you'd know if it wasn't working, but maybe not if it's leaking.
Yeah, I guess people just don't pay attention that much. They just wonder why their yard is always squishy and smelling.
But that ends up in the
And then it goes into the ditch river. And ends up in the Vermilion. Yeah. But believe it or not, ants are a big problem also.
How so?
Because the aerator systems that are used to aerate the septic tank get eaten alive by the ants because it's warmer in there. Ants try to go where they can be warmer and whatnot, get the heat to help uh-huh. hatch their eggs and whatnot. And they get into the pump stations, electric stations, and they just chew all the wiring up.
They are busy. Huh?
The ants they'll destroy our guys. They've seen more than one. Aerated, destroyed by an ant pile.
Hmm.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
We're partnering with LCG also to help some people because they're not very expensive, but sometimes it's beyond what some people can pay in the parish.
And then you've got to pay for labor and labor and whatnot.
And we're partnering with LCG and to find out ways to help fund some people who might need some assistance in getting their septic tank even pumped out. Also, people have to have it pumped out anywhere from five to seven years.
Right.
Also.
So you're partnering as far as funds go. So it'd be funding from the BVD and maybe
HUD through community development.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. HUD and community development. Yeah, I just see. Identifying people and being able to have monies available for those people.
That's good.
But most people, once they realize what's going on, they're, I got to get that taken care of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I guess once you put it in, you don't have to get it inspected every few years, or do you have to get it recertified?
Oh, you don't have to get it recertified, but that's another issue.
That's something
we're working with the legislature also. Because
like getting a driver's license, you should renew it every 4 years or 5 years.
You should, but you don't have to.
Yeah, and I know people don't like government, but they want it when they want it.
When it's there to keep us safe and healthy, for sure, and that's what the purpose is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you stay busy. We didn't even talk about latest controversies. You've got a new board. Half your board is reconstituted.
Well, I think we've come to an understanding of the relationship mm-hmm. between the two boards. We have the BVD board, of course, which is 9 members named mm-hmm. by different political elected officials, I guess you could say, the mayor president of Lafayette Parish and the city of Lafayette, the area mayors, is the mm-hmm. council of the other mayors in Lafayette Parish, and the city council and the parish council.
Yeah.
And we're very excited to have a lot of new board members, a lot of new blood, a lot of new ideas, a lot of new energy, mm-hmm. And then we have also the Vermilionville Living History Museum Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, which is staffed mainly by UL professors and community activists, and there as an advisory role also for our historical presentations. And also, like I said, for us to be able to get some grants. We get, thousands of dollars of grants every year thanks to their 501c3. And people are able to get a little tax write-off because they're donating to a 501c3 mm-hmm. charity.
Right, right. Well, David Cheremy, thank you so much mm-hmm. for making time and sharing what your role is here in our community. I think it impacts all of us, and I'm hoping that people listening will tell others, either, let's go together, let's go visit.
Sure, come to Vermilionville. I mean, yeah. it's there for you. It's a public it's there for the public good.
Yeah.
You know, it's a public.
You got a great website to look at. What the website, if you want to mention
it. It's BayouVermilionDistrict.org. Vermilion, just one L in Vermilion.
Right.
Also,
you can see hours of operation.
We're open 6 days a week, Tuesday through Sunday. Our village is open. We have artisans in several of the houses dressed mm-hmm. in costumes and can tell you the history and the different crafts that people used to participate in back in those days. So it's a very enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
And they're all wearing masks also. So we're all very conscious about our social distance and our masks.
Right. Well, David Sheremy, CEO of Bayou Vermilion District, thank you again for joining us. I'd like to thank our listeners. Please subscribe to Discover Lafayette. David's interview is probably... we've done almost 190 now. You can find all of our interviews on discoverlafayette.net. And you can also subscribe to the podcast. And please leave a review if you do that. I'd also like to thank our sponsors. First, Iberia Bank, which is now a part of First Horizon. Ochsner Lafayette General, thank you for all of your support. And last but not least, Raider, and especially Jason Sikora, who mixes our tape and makes it sound professional. Thank you all. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, I'm Jan Swift.